Thank you for tuning in to the Spectator podcast today. Before you get to the action, we'd just like to flog an offer. It's 12 issues for £12, along with a £20 Amazon voucher. Do the math, something's not quite right, so grab it while you can. Just go to www.spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Gus Carter, and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. On Wednesday, the MP Douglas Ross was announced as the new leader of the Scottish Conservative Party, following the surprise resignation of Jackson Carlaw last week. James, can you just tell us a little bit about the challenges that Ross will face north of the border?
Well, I think his challenge is that the Scottish Tories had a bad result at the last general election, lost a bunch of seats. There is a Holyrood election coming up in 2021, and it looks like the Scottish Tories are in line for another bad result. And that is a particular problem for the government, because the SNP manifesto will undoubtedly have a commitment in it to a second independence referendum. And if they end up with a pro-independence majority in the Scottish Parliament, it will make the situation with the union far more fraught. You know, Downing Street say, we will just say no to a second independence referendum. I'm not sure how long just a simple no can last as an answer to that question. And so that is the challenge. I think the big problem is the Scottish Tory revival, as Alex Massey says in the coming issue of the Spectator, was basically based around two things, Ruth Davidson and the constitutional question. That we know that London would like the Scottish Tories to downplay the constitutional issue, because it's harder to say no to a second independence referendum if the Scottish Tories have fought the election on stop Indy Ref 2 and the SNP win. It becomes even more difficult just to say no. And, you know, Douglas Ross is not Ruth Davidson. Now, Ruth Davidson is coming back. She is going to take First Minister's questions. It's quite clear that her and those around her are behind this change in leadership. You know, Douglas Ross is her candidate. But, you know, Douglas Ross does not yet have the same name recognition in Scotland that Ruth Davidson has. He has a more interesting story than Jackson Carlaw, who is a kind of second-hand car salesman. You know, Douglas Ross is a, you know, international class football linesman. You know, you can see things like that. But it is going to be a massive challenge when you look at how high Nicola Sturgeon's approval ratings are and how ubiquitous a presence she's been in Scottish life. I mean, there's an amazing stat that she has done every single one of the Scottish government's coronavirus briefings. And I think that has, you know, that has cemented her position in Scottish politics, and so Douglas Ross has quite a mighty task ahead of him.
Ross won the backing of Ruth Davidson very early on in the race. In fact, you can't even really call it a race if there's only one candidate. Katie, why did no one else stand against him?
When Jackson Carlaw announced that he was stepping down, it took many by surprise, but I think there was some choreography going on behind the scenes, which was the sense that he came to the decision, but I think others also came to the decision, watching him and his leadership, that he wasn't the person to take the party forward. And I think that the decision was made at the best time in terms of Tory survival, in terms of getting things done, to have a change of leader, was to have this break before the Scottish Parliament returned. Jackson kind of made the decision to stand down. And then I think there was just a sense you had to move fairly quickly. I don't think anyone really wanted the bother of actually going through a contest. It's more the sense that you have a limited amount of time now running up until the election next year, and the new leadership have all that time to build. I still think we have a piece for Alex Massey in the magazine this week, and you never know when there is a one-horse race if you're going to have a rogue candidate, perhaps a junior councillor, to say, oh, this should be a contest, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring. So there's a bit of refreshing of the announcements in the lead up to press deadline, just in case you did get someone like that coming forward. But I think in terms of more the Conservative establishment and the Scottish Conservative Party, there is a sense that they don't really have the time to faff around about who, you know, how to pressurise candidates, test them out. Mm. And actually, you just got to get straight to it. There's also the case that there's not that many people to choose from. Now, we believe that Douglas Ross is going to stay as the MP in Westminster up until this election, but I think that it's such a difficult role, it's not really something which is necessarily seen as a position you're going to enjoy doing for the next, you know, 6 months.
The Scottish Tories under Ruth Davidson had a bit of a reputation for acting somewhat independently of Theresa May when she was Prime Minister. Do you think that's something that Douglas Ross will continue?
Yeah, I think that he resigned from the government over Dominic Cummings' trip to Barnard Castle, saying that he couldn't defend it. And his supporters are clearly trying to make a virtue of that he's his own man, that he won't be afraid to kind of tell London uncomfortable truths. I think the challenge there is you've got to get this balance right. When you push on something, you've got to know that you are likely to win on it, because that helps you. You don't want to push on something, not get anywhere, and have the SNP say, look, they're impotent, they can't even persuade their Tory colleagues to do that. You know, so I think, you know, I suspect there'll be the kind of classic pre-budget, you know, whiskey duty must be frozen kind of stuff. I think the bigger question is, I think the current model of devolution is clearly eating away at the union. It doesn't work, because it enables the SNP to differentiate themselves where they want to and blame London where they choose to. And I think the question, the more profound question is, what do you do about the structure of the union? I think you can clearly say that with the benefit of hindsight, the way devolution was done was wrong. Is it really possible to roll it back? I'm sceptical. And I wonder whether that leads you down a route to a more federal UK. But clearly something is happening, because I think the current devolution settlement is eroding the foundations of the union.
Back down in Westminster, there's growing pressure on the Conservatives to suspend an as-yet unnamed former minister after he was arrested over the weekend over allegations of rape. Katie, why haven't the Conservatives suspended this MP?
I think there are a few reasons for this. They've clearly come under criticism, but I think one reason you hear is innocent until proven guilty. But the other big reason is, I think, partly identification, which is if you remove the whip from a Tory MP, it isn't too long before that would probably become public, you know, in terms of, you know, who didn't hold the whip. And I think there's a sense that as soon as you do that, some argue that then that would increase the chance of the victim coming under perhaps pressure or attention. Now, there are those on the other side who say this is all a load of hogwash and this is simply to protect the MP and these arguments don't hold weight. But I think those are along the lines of why the Tory party is not doing anything yet. And they want to ultimately see the case run and then make a decision. You definitely have heard rumblings from a few anonymous Conservative MPs that they would like to see a bit more firm action here. You've had a former Conservative MP, the former whip, and Milton come out and say actually the MP in question should voluntarily have the whip withdrawn, should actually say it's not up to the party, I'm going to do the right thing here, and while this case is in play, I'm not going to do it. But it's a situation where I don't imagine either side, you know, are going to move here. I don't think the Conservative Party is about to change tack.
And finally, earlier today, the Home Affairs Select Committee issued a report stating that because the government didn't impose quarantine rules at the beginning of the pandemic, around 10,000 infected travellers entered the UK. James, do you think that when the inquiry eventually comes around, this, alongside the care homes policy, will be an area of serious scrutiny?
Yeah, look, I think if you look at that ONS status on data on excess deaths, what was striking was that England has the highest excess deaths in Europe, and you know, with Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland not far behind. And the question is, how come you've got the highest excess deaths in Europe when we didn't have kind of one massive outbreak like Lombardy in Italy, for example, or even Madrid in Spain? And the evidence seems to be pointing to the idea that that was because the infection was kind of seeded across the country by people coming back from half-term breaks in Spain and Italy and places such as that. And I think with the benefit of hindsight, it would clearly have been better to have introduced kind of quarantine measures then. I always thought that when the government introduced its quarantine policy, it was kind of slightly shutting the door after the horse had bolted. The problem had occurred. And so I think it is absolutely certain that kind of public inquiry that will be like, well, why wasn't this done? Why weren't procedures taken at airports to do this? And I think that is undoubtedly true. I think it is also quite clear when you look at the fact that the UK had, you know, how evenly across the UK you have had these outbreaks. It is all very consistent with a pattern of this virus, of people having returned to the virus and gone to all different parts of the UK. I think it's one of the interesting questions now, which is, you know, what is now the best approach in terms of this? I think one thing the government should be much clearer about is what triggers quarantine. You know, for example, you know, if you go to Spain, you have to quarantine for 14 days when you come back. If you go to Luxembourg, you have to quarantine for 14 days when you come back. I think it would be useful if people had on both the quarantine policies for countries abroad and for the local lockdowns some idea of the criteria the government were using to make these decisions.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And thank you for listening. Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.